Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We have a really special guest on with us this evening. Interestingly enough, I did not know his name, and I know a lot of things in literacy, but it is a real pleasure to get to know our guest. His name is Bruce Howlett, and I first discovered Bruce from reading his blog that was on the Learning by Design website. And I'm a member of Spell Talk, and I shared it with Judy, and we said to ourselves, we have to get Bruce on. So the article is Our Choice: Rapidly Translate, Evaluate, and Adopt Innovative Literacy Methods, or Prolong the Reading Wars. And it was written by Bruce and Caitlin. Is Caitlin your wife?
Caitlin is my daughter, actually.
Oh, Caitlin's your daughter. How wonderful. Okay.
She's a PhD and assistant professor in educational studies. But her background's more on the philosophy and history of education. So it's just good for me to have somebody that can, you know, frame things like that.
That's great. And how nice that you get a chance to work with your daughter. That's great. So this article was written on September 6th. So it's fairly recent. And let me just tell you about Bruce's background. So Bruce Howlett applies his long experience in biological research at Cornell University when developing innovative instruction for his special education students. For over 30 years, Bruce has worked with literacy researchers, speech therapists, and reading teachers to create innovative instruction for long-struggling readers. Sparking the Reading Shift is his fifth project. Bruce believes in the power of innovative methods as his own difficulties with reading fluency, spelling, and listening dissipated when, at the age of 40, he began working with a speech therapist on phonemic awareness lessons for their mutual students. That's so cool. That also attracted me, by the way.
Yeah.
That you're somebody who speaks from having your own difficulties. And that's always fascinating to me. Bruce is currently working on Sparking the Fluency Shift, which combines 15 rehearsal activities that allow the student to practice challenging words and phrases before reading short stories that are arranged by lexile level. So, Bruce, you have a really interesting background, so I can't wait to dig in. So, you wrote this article, and right in the title, you said something about reading wars. The reading wars. And that's what many of us know for many years, having been in education for many years. My co-host Judy Boxner also has been in education for many years. So we're very familiar with the term reading wars. And it's all about the idea that there are these opposing sides and that we really need to stop these wars because it's not benefiting the children. So could you give us a little bit of background in terms of your view? I don't know why I'm echoing. Sorry about that. In any case, could you give us a little bit of background about what made you write this blog and a little bit about your perspective?
Yes. I got into reading late in life, or second career, actually, at 40s late. I don't think it's late anymore. After working at Cornell University in biological research, and I worked with a professor who was well known in the field. And when it started, there was a grad student who contradicted this famous chair professor, his research, and it was very controversial. And about 6 years later, another research group at another university realized that that grad student's work was actually right. And it always sounds like I'm overstating it, but that group won a Nobel Prize for that discovery. It's about how cells make energy, a very fundamental process. So I've always learned, and especially working at Cornell, everybody is it's scientific inquiry. You're always asking questions. Things are never good enough. You're always discovering more. And after a downturn in funding during the first Bush administration, I went to work to teach science at a school for emotionally disturbed teens, a residential school. And surprise, surprise, they couldn't read, except for one child who, another unfortunately great story, was there because he had shot his English teacher. The teacher survived. He came from a family that was very troubled. The dad was a Vietnam vet. And I got really interested in it. And my wife's a Montessori teacher. And Montessori, because Maria Montessori was from Italy, there's no real formal way of teaching reading. And at the time, they were like, well, should we be doing phonics or should we be doing whole language? And they were fighting back and forth. That was my first introduction. And I looked for real scientific research going into the type of journals that Cornell had. And I didn't see anything, really. So I really got interested. The first thing was phonemic awareness back in the 90s was really becoming very popular and prevalent. And I got interested in it. And I said, well, I got to go work in elementary school because this is too hard working with high school students. And that's where the action is, right? I mean, we can do a lot down there. And I asked the speech therapist one day, do you know anything about this phonemic awareness stuff? And she said, well, let me go. There's a conference, an ASHA conference. Well, let me go. When we come back, we'll talk about it. And I worked in the school with one teacher was a reading recovery teacher and the other was Orton Gillingham. And the speech pathologist was pointing out that there were weaknesses in both. And I was like, what? You know, they're very respected programs, especially back then, maybe not now, but and she gave me she knew that I had a history of problems with reading, spelling, and writing. And she gave me a very simple phonemic awareness test called the Op-Singer, which people haven't heard of recently. And she said, you have issues, not simple ones, but very high level ones. So, but her perspective was we need to look at speech and language. We need to look at other things. And that set me on a course to say, okay, just keep questioning what they do. That led me down the road to creating software and other programs through the first company I was with. And I continued to always try it every 2 or 3 or 4 years, just like throw a lot of stuff out and start over. And I did that recently with a research we'll talk about. And I want to thank Dr. Jan Wasowicz, who put the article on her blog, because she is also the same type of person. I'm not equal to her. She's on a higher level, who's always inquisitive, always wants to look for something better. And so we have been kind of in parallel building different things to help kids using the next level, I would say, of reading instruction.
That's fascinating. I agree with you about Jan. You know, I always follow what she writes, love her whole thinking process. She's brilliant. You said something so interesting, Bruce. I'm going to bring Judy into this because you mentioned how the SLP in the building said that there were holes in both reading recovery and Orton Gillingham OG. And Judy, since I met her, always said that she learned so much from reading recovery and what a positive experience it was. Now, I'm very familiar with reading recovery. I taught first grade. I had training in it, but I didn't go through the whole process of it. But I could tell you that I saw that many of the students I received who needed remediation, all of those students had reading recovery. They were not recovered after having reading recovery. And so I had a really bad taste in my mouth about reading recovery. And I'm sure, as you know, a lot of other people have said the same things, that it did not do what it was designed to do, to basically turn things around in a short period of time in first grade. So, Judy, I'm going to bring you in now. So Bruce is saying that this SLP said that there are holes in both. I would certainly agree that there are holes in Orton-Gillingham. I am the first one to say there are definitely holes, and that's why I'm always looking for other things, and that's why I had other training and speech to print, which I actually had before Orton-Gillingham. I did phonographics. And
I remember phonographics.
Phonographics was, you know, is a great program. And recently I've had Sounds Right training. And so I always try to take everything and choose what really worked. So I would definitely agree. There are holes in OG. Judy, why don't you jump in and maybe share some of your experiences about the holes that you saw in reading recovery and what you saw that was positive about it.
So I'm a little under the weather today, so I apologize to everybody. But, you know, I think I've always been pretty honest about my journey, right? So I was in the role of reading recovery for 4 years. I know some people that are speaking about it did it for 1 year. Maybe they just know about it. That was my life for 4 years. And at that time, I thought I was going to change the world. This was the most exciting opportunity I had ever been offered. And, you know, the training was intensive. We had to be behind a glass window where everybody would watch us. So I felt really vulnerable. We learned to get feedback constantly about best practices. We learned to watch every move an educator made. There were many things that were wonderful. We spoke about it on many episodes. The Elkhonen boxes linked directly with phonemic awareness and sounds. Reading behaviors, looking at how the finger touches a word and slides from word to word, watching how a kid holds a pencil. Those were really great things.
I would
working
agree.
On phrasing and fluency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about what does a period do? How does your voice change for a question mark? But the honest truth is, I think there were really big holes. And one of the biggest holes for me was how we taught kids how to decode. I was not very strong at that. I wish I was better at that when I was teaching it, but I wasn't. Very often I would look at the word with the kid would make the first sound, then they would look at the picture, they would go back and forth, the head would go like this, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And very often, even if I didn't direct a kid to guess the word, that's exactly what they did, because they got their mouth ready, potentially didn't know the word. And a lot of the kids that I was working with were English language learners. And there was no way that they were going to guess potentially a multisyllabic word in like level A. And, you know, looking back now, because I have 7 years of intensive structured literacy training, it didn't follow a scope and sequence. It really didn't. It was more natural, and there was exposure, and there was discussions of phonics. But it really, I didn't understand the progression of how to follow a scope and sequence.
So, and so Judy, I'm going to jump in. I'm going, okay.
Wait, one more thing.
Go ahead.
Even with my raspy voice, this is how passionate I feel about it. I think there was such great attention to the topic of meaning. And we all know, whether we're reading recovery or in Gillingham or anything else, we all know meaning is very important.
Yes.
But the same love and respect should have been given to the power of decoding and how that connects to meaning.
Yes.
So, and I would say with my Orton-Gillingham training that I did find it took a very long, long time to work with kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, these kids didn't have that kind of time. And there are more efficient, effective ways to go about doing this. There's also a heavy reliance on rules that many kids cannot hold on to a lot of those rules.
Yeah.
You know, I could go on and on, but I want to hear from you, Bruce. So what do you propose? So there are holes. We read this article and I read it with great interest. You had mentioned that you started to question lots of people and to look at well-respected researchers. Let's hear about that.
Yeah. So where the article goes and where I am at, and in parallel where Jen Wozowicz is at and a lot of other people, is if you look at the current research from Dr. Linnea Airey, who's, of course, known for orthographic mapping, Marianne Wolfe, who is originally known for rapid automatized naming, but now is into what I really think is the next level, which is multi-component instruction. Mark Seidenberg, who says we cannot teach the step-by-step way. Okay, now I do phonemic awareness, and then I do, you know, more letter sound, and then maybe I'll teach morphology. But, you know, kids eventually, Judy brought up multisyllable words, and that's a very important piece. And for me, the goal and what these new methods really help with is getting kids not just through the decoding piece, which is absolutely essential. There's no question about it. But the next piece is third or fourth grade, multisyllabic, words that have multiple morphemes, which aren't always the same, or words that are more irregular. And there are these same methods that combine a lot of pieces, multi-component, integrated multi-component instruction is what it's called, include these pieces in one piece. So instead of having to teach all these pieces, or like Orton-Gillingham, which takes a very long time, you can do a lot of things a lot faster. And for me, because I'm ultimately someone who likes the kids to get going real quickly so I can be more lazy in the classroom, because we knock ourselves out. And so many people are so tired. These methods actually make it simpler to teach. So what it is it's called integrated multi-component instruction. And the three minimum pieces that you combine are the phonemic piece, the orthographic piece, which is spelling, and it can obviously phonemes and graphemes begin that. You need that base underneath. There's no question about that. I listened to your talk with my friend, Dr. Sam Bomarito, right? And we can't spend that kind of energy, right? But he points to the same thing you did, Faith, and that is meaning's got to get into this very, very early on. And by pulling these pieces together and integrating the meaning parts, which are the semantic pieces and the morphology, with the basic parts, which is the orthographic mapping using phonemic awareness and orthographic awareness, you're pulling this all together and you get these increases, not just in decoding, but automatic reading of meaningful multisyllabic words. So we want to raise the standards, but it's crazy to say, oh, let's raise the standards. You were part of Faith, part of Reading First, right? A very, yes, very intensive effort at that. There's no sense in telling teachers we're going to raise the standards unless they give them tools to actually be able to do it in an easier way. Mm-hmm. The other piece, before I sound like I'm just advocating for the work that we do, is that this is easier on the kids because the instruction follows principles of cognitive learning or cognitive learning principles, such as recall of instruction, space distributed instruction, where the kid is more actively involved, his memory is being not just memorized, but pulling stuff out of memory. Memory retrievals solidify instruction. And these are all integrated into it. So you get a easier, more involved child, especially with so many kids with ADHD, right? Mm-hmm. And in a form that makes more sense to them, that you can really make it easier on everybody. And I think that's the goal. The other goal, as you mentioned earlier, is we need to raise this discussion. And we can't spend more energy on the reading wars. It's draining us all. It's mm-hmm. not going anywhere. And, you know, reading first to me, unfortunately, why did that fail? I mean, we tried our hardest, billions of dollars. You can answer that if you want to.
Well, I have some thoughts on that. Look, I talked about this in my book, in Failing Students or Failing Schools. Yeah. There was a book prior to that. That was my first book. But I talked about my experiences, having done this for many years. And reading first was one of the most exciting things I was ever involved in, because I saw a turning point at that point. And the letdown to think that this was dragged on another 20-something years after I was involved in it, thinking that that was the time we had so much science, Bruce, then.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thought that was still here having these same discussions just blows my mind. So why do I think that failed? Well, number one, it was punitive. Yeah. And basically, the districts that got the grant were the ones that were failing, right? Yeah. And so the teachers felt like, oh, so we have to do this. You know, that's the booby prize. We're getting this, and we have to follow all these rules. But then other teachers in schools that were higher performing, they didn't have to change what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you still had three queuing, and you still had all of, you know, the Lucy Loving stuff. And it didn't affect those schools, right? Yeah. So right away, there was this have and have not type of pull between the two. So if the science really was true science, shouldn't it have been spread all around?
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was only the low performing schools that received this grant. That's one of my issues. The other issue that was really huge in the reading first era was that there was no sustainability. We wanted to see that go on and to follow it. And then the money was being pulled and things were being pulled too soon before the schools had a chance to embrace it. And of course, you know, a lot of those schools have transient leadership. And so we started something and then they would leave to find a better job.
Yeah.
And then we were starting all over again.
Right.
So there were a lot of issues with that. But the science was there. Judy, you look like you're ready to jump in.
I just wanted to know, when did reading first, like what was the exact time frame of when it started and when it ended?
Yeah, so we're talking about right around the time of No Child Left Behind. So I would say, so that was 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
And so now we're in 2023. Okay. Having the same discussions.
No, I am thinking about that because I started teaching in 2000. So I probably was just a kid out of college. I heard about it, but it wasn't like in my blood and soul. I was just starting my career.
Right.
But what's interesting enough is in 2013 is when I got trained in reading recovery. So how did we go from that to that? And that was initiated through a grant through, you know, the government. It was an I-3
grant. Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. One of the things I put in the blog, which is actually very controversial, was a chart that I composed.
Yes. Of
the basic values and beliefs that we all have about science of reading, phonics, and whole language balanced literacy. Yeah. And my goal was that I wanted to start some people say, okay, there's maybe a little gap in here that we can start questioning some more. And it didn't quite work. It works in a lot of different environments. So, but when you have beliefs and values, just as we have in different political parties, which we're going through now, which we won't get into, people get really into their beliefs and into their values. And someone who I don't agree with at all his beliefs and values may resonate with other people, and they're very hard to change. So one of the things that I propose is we have a massive experiment with like all these different phonemic, morphological, orthographic, and also like semantic pieces, and find out the exact activities, the exact combination of these activities, and then hand tools to teachers. And I listened to your talk with Nate Joseph, who I've been able to have more than a few email conversations. She's great. And what he said, which stuck with me, was the piece about what really kind of works is you give teachers tools, you provide them with coaching, which you both expanded on very nicely, I thought, and you do explicit instruction. And these methods, the multi-component methods, they all start out with very clear, explicit instruction. They are tools that, especially both my materials and what Jen has in Learning by Design, they're tools that you can teach teachers to use fairly regularly. But I think we got to get there so that we can stop the debate and start saying, okay, let's see what works. The other thing that really changes teachers' minds, and I'm sure you've both seen it, is when they see results with their own kids in their own classroom. It means little, and this bothers me as, you know, with a science background, it means little what the research says, because the research is really, you know, Dr. Sam has very good research behind what he does. It's very different, and I don't always agree with it. But there's research there. He actually, International Literacy Association put out special issues on the reading wars and how to overcome them. A lot of great ideas from more of a balanced literacy side. No one's defending free queuing, though Dr. Sam did it. But they also invited Linnea Airy, Mark Seidenberg, Dr. Timothy Shanahan, you know, my hero, so to speak. And we need this discussion on the next level. And the other piece that I think is very important, if we're going to go to this multi-syllabic level, what really seems to be a piece that's really emerging from the research is making sure that the phonemic, orthographic, and morphological pieces are used in a way that it increases metalinguistic flexibility, which is a big mouthful, but it's on Jan Wasowicz. Every time she mails something out, it says that's what she does. And really that is you have to teach kids, there's tons of parts that inform you about a word, not just, but the very important basic one is obviously phonemes and graphemes and knowing how to use them in phonemic awareness. But onset rhyme patterns, morphemes themselves, which change as the pronunciation, syllables, longer spelling patterns, and that behind the brain, behind our conscious effort, that's why we're able to read words. When we see new words we never read, we can figure them out because we have all this other information about the word. And Dr. Airy says, and the more information you have about a word, the easier it is to read these words. And we look at kids like my daughter, with a PhD in education. She was reading at 4 or 5 years old. I thought it was because my wife's a Montessori teacher, but she had all her friends were doing the same. And when they got to third grade, their progress accelerated because they had all these components and they needed less of basic instruction and spent more time enjoying the reading and things like that. And what that complex metalinguistic flexibility really means is you have what I call, you get what phonics gives you is a very important basic set of Lego pieces. And the Lego pieces for the basic sets, you have a son. One of you has a son, right? Maybe both. My son's 35.
We all have sons. Yeah.
Okay, good. The basic Lego sets have clear instruction, explicit instructions how to use it. And my son, actually, there's adult Lego sets with all kinds of complicated pieces. And my son loves doing it. I just visited him in Pittsburgh when I was listening to all your podcasts. But the instructions, he throws away the instructions. And that at some point you need to get rid of the basic instructions. and be able to put these parts, all these complex parts, you know, hundreds of different word parts together on your own without a lot of help. So the other really big push.
I love that analogy. That's awesome. Yeah.
I like that. Yes. Actually, I wasn't the first person to say that, but I'll take credit for it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I just love what you're saying. Now, this is very interesting, Judy. Bruce mentioned our episode with Dr. Sam. And, you know, the interesting thing is we always talk about bringing different sides together, right? And trying to talk to each other. That was the whole point of about bringing Dr. Sam on the show. And yet, somehow, it kind of did not go as well as we had hoped. And yet, listening to Bruce, I find myself nodding my head quite a bit in agreement with you. Because I do, and I know Judy does, we really feel strongly that phonics is just one piece of the puzzle. And I really do believe that Dr. Sam thinks that as well. But yet somehow, some of the most basic things that we were talking about, like the science and, you know, something as simple as like an assessment, that I just felt that there was just no way of bringing some people around to see that, you know, there are some things you can't question and some things that are in plain sight. So, Judy, what do you think might have gone off with our last episode with Dr. Sam? And yet I see you smiling when Bruce is talking and you see me kind of nodding. What, why is that?
So, my voice is a mess.
Do the best you can.
When I was in reading recovery, I found that most of the people that were in that cohort with me were extremely open-minded. And I stayed in contact with many of those people that I was in training with. And many of us have gone down this path of the science. I know one of my colleagues is now working for Really Great Reading. One of my colleagues is trained in Spire, and she's an IEP teacher. And I feel that many of my colleagues that are not as vocal on social media have really embraced looking at the science, looking at what worked and what didn't work. But I found that that interaction, I didn't feel like I was sitting with one of my friends. Yeah. One of my friends that was open-minded and listening, I almost felt like, are we speaking the same language? Did you live my life? Do you know about Acadians? Do you know what a powerful tool it is in terms of letting us understand? Can kids understand and also break that code? Then that discussion where I talked about the application piece and how, you know, as I'm working with kids, decodables right now have been such a critical piece of seeing kids see something in isolation that they see in phonics and now being able to apply those skills into text. Yeah. I felt like I was just fighting a battle. There was like, it was like almost more like, and I don't, you know, I know he means well and he's a good person and that's fine. But I felt like it was more of like, I'm just proving a point. Levels are fine too. And there's lots of research that decodables don't work. There's research on everything. But when you're in the field and you see kids that are suffering because they've been given mixed messages in the classroom and their brain is like, what the hell do you want me to do right now? Because I can't read.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I just didn't feel that level of talking about being in the field.
Yeah.
I think what makes Faith and I really unique is we're always talking about what it feels like to be in the field. I mean, I was in the field today.
Yes.
Faith was in the field today.
Yes.
So it didn't feel like I was amongst a friend having a discussion about, yeah, this was great, but maybe this is not great. Or, you know, I could see how that works. It was just like me, like trying to prove myself. and trying to hear, oh, yeah, that makes sense, but I didn't feel it.
So now that's basically, Bruce, what you talked about in this article.
Yeah.
Bringing it back to the article, I'm going to say, you said there is this endless debate.
Yeah.
And it does really feel endless. And you said here, importantly, this divide in values has widened into a cultural dispute with opposing camps more interested in protecting their chosen beliefs and practices than embracing creative solutions. Please share how do you go about doing this? Because it does seem endless. It does seem endless.
It does.
Let's hear from you. What do you think?
I want to first say that the part about, Judy, that you brought up about assessment with Dr. Sam, and as I said, I really respect him, but I know those values that you don't need to test kids are deeply ingrained in that whole, it's almost a worldview, right? And I think, Faith, you brought up in maybe the same podcast, but I'm not sure, it becomes part of our identity. And that's true. And I was talking to, I was emailing Christy Austin, who wrote a paper with, I forget the other author, but they wrote the recent review of Elizabeth Stevens, that showed that, you know, it was not something that had enough data and maybe shouldn't be, you know, states shouldn't just adopt it. And there were real questions about using the derivatives, Wilson, for example. And I asked her in the email, because I got a lot of flack for saying those kind of things, but I got a lot of positive feedback too. So I said, you know, how do you deal with this? And she says, we have to, in my words, we have to do the same thing that we're talking about. We have to raise the discussion. We have to understand where people are coming from, but also that there are things that here, if we move forward, that really are not things that we should negotiate. Because if you really develop, you know, orthographic mapping using phonemic, orthographic, and morphological instruction in this multilingualistic way, and that's a mouthful. I mean, we should simplify that to make it something we can just say in one eye. She said, you're going to develop fluency and you're going to increase comprehension, just the way decoding increases comprehension, right? And that should be something that's very appealing to people who teach balanced literacy. This is an easier way to get to the point where you can get into deeper text, that you can really have greater discussions, but they're not, it's very, she said, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that it's not an easy discussion to have. Her research is all, or recent research, including her PhD work, is on connecting word identification with word meaning, with a big bridge in there with morphology and how we use words and how words play out in sentences. So a lot of people are going this way. It's not something we're going to solve tomorrow. I know people in the science of reading who are quite famous that I've been part of discussions with recently. And I am at times appalled how they are also dug in. And they are resisting these types of changes. Some are still saying you just have to teach phonemes and graphemes. And we know that's not true, but they work with kids in kindergarten. So maybe it is true in kindergarten. But let's try to raise the discussions. There are a lot of ways that we can do it. There's tons of lessons out there. Both on Jan's website, Learning by Design, if you want a link to the blog, it's in the top of my site, which is half talking about what we're talking about. In the very bottom, you know, I talk about the lessons I provide for kids.
We're going to put it in the notes, Bruce.
Okay, readingshift.com.
Yeah, we're going to put your website in the notes and a link to the article. So that won't be
that would be awesome.
A problem.
Okay.
That won't be a problem.
Yeah.
Interesting how you said that SOR structured literacy, whatever you want to call that camp, you know, can dig their heels in as well. And I've seen that too. I am a strong proponent of structured literacy.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, but I have seen how they can also be narrow-minded in some ways. And interesting listening to all this. I have so many thoughts as I'm listening to what you're saying. I do want to leave, though, with the idea, just as I'm thinking about it, with Orton Gillingham. You said something that, you know, some people have negative things to say about it, but I do want to clearly say there are many children who are helped with that approach. I don't want to leave this discussion with people thinking that, you know, it doesn't work because I can rattle off lots of people, including my own students who were helped with Wilson or, you know, OG philosophy. So I don't want to leave people with that. But I think we're all open-minded to want to get to the most efficient, effective ways of teaching kids. So I know Judy's a learner. She's always like, oh, I want to find out about that. I'm a learner. You know, I'm like talking to Leslie Laud, Dr. Leslie Laud, about her writing approaches. So I'm always trying to move the needle and be open to different things. So I know what you're saying, that it's hard, and maybe it's the way we're approaching this in discussions. So what do you recommend? What to get this started? Because Judy and I have this podcast. We don't want another episode of really fighting with people. We like this, you know, having a nice open discussion. So what do you recommend? What is it that we need to do or others need to do to keep the line of communication open?
Right. That's interesting. I think one of the things you might do, and Dr. Wasowicz is an incredibly busy person. I got an hour of her time, but it was after 6 weeks. And she's a wonderful person, too. But it might be worth having her on as well. Mm-hmm. Her website, Learning by Design, she's been doing this for a long time. This exact approach, not exact approach, it is moving. Just like science and reading, you know, a lot of people are really into it, and that's wonderful. But it's in an early stage, and talking with Jan today. We're both talking about I modified the one program I have. It's been out for 2 years, 7 times, and just be open to we've got it. We're at the beginning of this process, but the consensus research. If you really want to talk about research at a high level, people we all admire. Is definitely going in this one direction. So there's a lot of research. My website, I have links to articles by all the people that I named, Marianne Wolf, Dr. Seidenberg, et cetera. You can start there and start reading. I also feel that it's not up to a teacher to read research and figure out what to go on in the classroom. Judy, you're nodding your head. It takes me, and I've been reading, you know, molecular biology research, for decades, and there are papers that I cannot get through and figure out, even especially morphology, since that's something I'm trying to get better at, because the papers also don't tell you what to do in the classroom. That's not what research is about. It's the same this approach. So there's a lot of resources. It's a good place to start. And if you type in multi-component instruction or a metalinguistic and reading. And the other thing which I'm really interested in at the moment, I said I'm working on this is my current research project. And look at how people are really looking at fluency, not as far as fluency and automaticity, developing it without, as you mentioned, you know, just relying on decodables. I use decodables with some kids, you have to. But you need richer language, you need more different types of words for them to read. Prosody, depending on what part of the English-speaking world you're in. and how those components play together. The other place for both subjects is the Florida Center for Reading Research, and they have it by grade level. Here's what you should do if you really went up to date on fluency. Word sentence pyramids, where you start off, have the kid read a word, read two words in a sentence or three words in a sentence. Simple things like that are very powerful. Breaking words, breaking sentences, or even text into phrases, very powerful, very simple. So while I've been kind of talking theoretically, when you get down to the nitty gritty, you can do all these things. I would recommend for morphology, there's a program, Structured Word Inquiry, by Peter Bowers, whose mother, Pat Bowers, wrote all the papers on rapid naming with Marianne Wolf. He has a history, it's in his heritage.
Bruce, I'm just going to jump in for a second.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Bauer brothers, right?
Yes. Yes.
So I don't know.
I mentioned one Bauer brother.
But okay. But the Bowers, you know, there's been fighting even on the SOR side with the Bowers because of their approach. So you see, there's even in the same camp, there is this, do we do morphology or do we do, this systematic phonics? And then we have speech to print or print to speech.
Yes.
And that's also all science of reading. Yes. So even on the same side, we can't seem to have this conversation without maybe attacking a side. At least that's what it appears. So I don't know, if you're familiar with the Bowers, but that's all morphology. It's
right. I know that the two brothers with Jeffrey Bowers wrote a very controversial paper, which inflamed a lot of people. And I'm staying away from that. But Peter Bowers really understands that we need to move this discussion higher. And he's helping educate me as far as that goes. So I don't want to put it off. I thought of one other thing. Keep going. I forgot what it was.
No, I just, in listening to you, all I keep thinking is that a lot of this is about human nature wanting to be right.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter what the topic is. It's kind of wanting to be right or proving somebody else wrong,
Judgmental.
Right. No matter
how we're so good at being judgmental, even to ourselves, of course.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Judy, so, I know that in your school that you got a core program now. Does HMH, right? And that's what a lot of the schools are picking now, HMH, or they're picking Witten Wisdom or L, right? The EL. So Bruce, Judy's in a school where they're adopting this core program. Does your multi-component approach, do you see that in the core programs? Shouldn't the core program be multi-component? I mean, what are you seeing?
They are not there. For example, the three programs that New York City schools, which you're smiling, Jay, so.
It's a rhetorical question. I know it's not, but I want to hear it from you.
No, because this is really something, it doesn't have to dominate your whole day. That's the other thing. It doesn't even have to dominate your whole instruction. You can do these in smaller pieces and not take over the time that should be, better allotted to building knowledge or getting kids to enjoy reading, finding their interests and things like that. And I want to go back one step. And you brought up there's tension even within it. I recently heard a podcast by someone I respect about speech to print and print to speech, because that's a very important thing. And I listened to her, and that's the core of what Jan Wasowicz also does and a lot of other things. But this, what I'm talking about, this whole thing, she does in a speech to print manner because she is a speech pathologist. I know one actually had one person on the podcast, and I won't mention her name, and she very simplified the two. Oh, you need them both. I respect that person too. I want to say that, a very, very knowledgeable woman. But we're fairly early on in this, but there are tools out there. You don't have to give up what you're doing. You can add this to systematic phonics. And to go back to your point about Gillingham, what the issue is really, it doesn't get enough kids all the way there and it takes too much time. One of Dr. Sam's point is if we knew exactly how much phonics to teach kids, instead of putting them all in Orton-Gillingham or Wilson, life could be much easier. You know, we've all had kids that, comes into special ed and it's like, you know, a month or two of instruction, they're back in class. They're not, I wish there were more of them in special ed. But we need to find those things out. And the last part of my my blog, and we actually took that part down, was this massive experiment. Let's take all like dozens and dozens of these activities that we do with kids in all these different areas, and let's find different combinations with them, take them into schools and find out with different groups of kids down to, I was proposing kids who are bullied learn in a different way. We have a huge problem now with, kids with limited attendance is a better word for that. You know, there's a lot of limited attendance kids these days. They often don't come to school because they get remediated too much. Can we find something that we can help them with? So if we could, in my ideal dream world, we'd know pretty precisely how much or how little of these components that we could use with different groups of kids, then some of these kids are going to need a lot, right? We're going to always have those kids that are going to take years. So that we could spend our time doing more of the things that people on the balanced literacy side love to do, read to kids, read books, you know, get them in interest, find interest in things like that. And my last piece, which is since retiring, I've been working for a local school district at a Montessori school where my wife used to teach. And just three mornings a week, I just have four or five kids. The principal is, I've known her for 22 years, so it's none of the school politics. it's really nice. The special ed director, she talks to me twice a year, so I don't have to even bother you. And what Montessori does, and I think the ultimate thing to go out in a high plane, is they teach kids how to learn. And they get them interested in different subjects. And of course, they learn a lot of knowledge-based and they learn vocabulary. But they learn how to transfer that learning ability to other subjects. And one of my students, who is not quite autistic, hated to write like many kids on the spectrum do. And we got him interested in just basics with how to write sentences, kind of a writing revolution type things. And he wanted to talk about wars, and he studied wars, Battle of Midway, and some World War I wars. And he raises chickens at his house. His parents are very high tech. I mean, Ithaca is a very, be near Cornell. But they raise chickens and they grow stuff. And I said, why don't you write a story about chickens that go to war? And he hated me for like a month, right? And then his sister started to do it. And then he started to do it. He wrote 16 pages over like a year. And he's in 4-H. And 4-H said, you got to take it to the state fair in Syracuse. We didn't have a discussion about Plainview. That's an inside joke. I grew up near where Faith is. He won a blue ribbon. So we're involved in a complex process, right? But there are a lot of components that can make this a lot easier. And that's kind of like almost my final word, unless you want to ask me one more thing.
Yeah. Well, Judy, do you have any thoughts? Because I just have one more thought about the chart, the table. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I had written.
Go ahead, Judy. You're reading my mind.
And it also, the other thought is legislation. A lot of legislations are changing and they're mandating certain things. And then how does that all fit in? Because things do change. Science evolves, research evolves. So how does that all fall into place? Because if you're mandating something and then the research says, now it should look different, how do we make sure that things are going in the right direction? And like something like Bruce, who's going to be open-minded enough when certain programs have been adopted and certain methods have been adopted, like, you know, maybe foundations, HMH, EL, how does somebody like Bruce say, hey, listen to me too?
Yeah. Faith, do you want to ask the question or do you want me to answer hers first?
Answer Judy first. And okay. Then, yes.
One of the connections that Jen Wasowicz is connecting, one of the connections she's connecting me with, it's getting late, isn't it? Is a woman who is a pretty prominent researcher who's involved in Mississippi. And recently, as you probably know, Mississippi has made large gains in reading. They started very low. But there's a concern because they retain kids in third grade. And that's problematic. And they're getting the kids to third grade because they're doing the basics that we know are very, very good, you know. And but they're concerned because the number of kids that are getting retained in third grade, are the number is increasing, where if you really had good systematic phonics, explicit instruction, structured literacy in the early grades, that number should decrease. So the woman was upset by that same chart. And she said, do I have to throw out my 40 years of research? I said, no. But she really, after a while, this is that crack I want to get. She said, so maybe we should be doing what you and Jen are suggesting. Do I have an opening in Mississippi? Maybe. But you start to do these state pieces, and they failed in the past, unfortunately, like reading first fail is a too strong word. Timothy Shanahan says he's been through three of these cycles where we're going to introduce more phonics, you know, and reading first again is one of those. And he's afraid that we're going to just repeat the same mistakes again. But we need to open the cracks, start this kind of discussion, and you know, and say, okay, just a few people saying we could do something different and we can do something more for kids, it could go a very long way. So that, you know, I wish I had some ultimate solution.
Yeah. You know,
but I have a child now that I've been working with 2 years. He's a neighbor. I know his grandmother. I worked with his aunt. His father does not read. He worked in a factory here. He just retired. Could not read in third grade, working with speech pathologist. And all I could do was I kept going. I tried everything is start pulling more things in. You know, we don't have an ultimate solution. There isn't one. We just got to add some more pieces and to move forward.
So, Bruce, along the lines of this chart, last point, I promise you.
No, it's all right.
Was, you know, I read everything on that spell talk, and Steve Dykstra kind of, you know, went through your article and had some things to say. I have to say, I, you know, really agree with some of the things that he was saying.
Yes.
And one of the comments he made was this idea of having to check off something equally on both sides.
Yeah.
And, you know, like almost that, you know, you have to kind of balance out the criticism as well as what's good. And it doesn't happen that way, really. No. So what are your thoughts about what Steve said? Because we are bringing Steve Dykstra on the show. Yay.
Are you really good?
Oh, yes, we are. So you
know, I don't say this lightly. I respect him. I don't know if I responded to him or not. I threw a mutual friend who knows him. I had a discussion with her and she is talking to him. I am writing a new blog that's only 1,200 words, one third of the original one, and which I'll send to you just for so you know what's going on. Because I learned a lot about it. And I took Steve's criticisms to heart. He's been doing this again for a very long time. And I'm not trying to disprove his perspective at all. There are many perspectives about it. So I would love for you to ask him that. But as I said, I didn't feel like I wanted to rebut what he said and get back into another fight. And I am sending him this new blog, which Jan may put up in the next few months, whenever she gets 4 minutes, which is sometimes she does and sometimes she doesn't. But again, I want to respect, you know, where he's coming from. We have differences, opinions. I'm going to actually email him this new blog, as I said that. And just move forward, you know. This debate's going to go on, but if we can change the nature of the debate and then change what we're doing with kids in simple ways, that, you know, going back to the tools piece that Nate Joseph brought up, and not have to like make major changes, right? I would never like what I have to ever be mandated in a school, because it's not enough. So even with these fluency pieces, you know, this I feel is a gap between the foundational pieces and getting kids to really read, because, you know, level literacy is not the answer either. Even though I do that, that's not a complete solution. This is some kids are going to need this. And let's hope we can get to the point when they get to second or third grade and they need more fluency, more help with multisyllable words, that number is has shrunk. It's still has shrunken dramatically. So
yes. You know something? You are just a delightful person, Bruce.
Thank you.
You're just really, I hope we have more conversations outside of this podcast.
Anytime.
And, you know, you're just so level-headed and so bright and just really a pleasure to speak with. I'm just learning so much and I really can't wait to see your work. I just really am so excited about it. So thank you so much for being on with us. We
thank
are super happy. Judy,
good.
I'm not even going to put you through the whole thing with saying all our ways to get in touch with us. All I'm going to say is we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. Look for the Literacy View, Real Teachers Letting Loose. Thank you, everybody.
Can I ask you one question?